for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Inside Lacrosse editor-in-chief Matt Kinnear, my friend. And dude, it's been like coming up on a month since I've seen you. In the height of what should be lacrosse season, this is just impossible to wrap my head around. But we are working from home. We are quarantining. My family is safe and healthy, and I hope that yours is as well.
It's we're living in a bizarro world. You know, I would never think that. You know, this weekend I went to the creek behind my house, threw rocks in it with my son, and kind of wandered around saying, what the heck am I doing next? My Saturdays in the spring are pretty much planned out for me, you know, have been for the last 9 years. So it's a little bit of, you know, obviously there's fear, there's kind of worry and there's sorrow, but I think the cluelessness and kind of, you know, what we wrote in this last issue of what the heck do we do now is the overwhelming feeling that I'm going through right now.
Are you looking at the schedule on the website, like, just to wonder about what game you would have gone to, or did you find that to be, like, too torturous and you're not even looking at it?
I've gotten back to doing that, actually. The first week, I definitely looked at it, and we...
Yeah, you and I talked about it.
Yeah, and how long have we been? Because we stopped going to the office earlier than the governor did the shutdown.
Correct.
So we're, like, what, in our fourth week?
Yeah, this is the beginning of our fourth week.
Gotcha. So yeah, that first weekend that lacrosse season was canceled, I remember, you know, talking about like, oh, I'd be at Loyola Bucknell right now. And then I kind of looked away from it and tried to like focus on other things and tried to get my house in order as much as possible. I think now that we've gotten into a pretty good routine as a company, I think, in terms of, you know, how our work week looks, what we're doing Monday through Friday, as opposed to our normal kind of haphazard schedule of working weekends and having off days during the week. So now that we've gotten kind of some sense of normalcy, I've kind of been looking back at it. And it's funny because I sent a text to Scott Maher on Friday night that said, hey, man, I'm sorry that, you know, Syracuse is supposed to be in town right now. I know how much of a big deal that game is to him and to the entire capital region. And, you know, who would have thought that they finally get that on the schedule and then this is going to happen? So I'm starting to look back at that stuff.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that. See, you just bummed me out all over again. Ugh. I mean, I was looking at, you know, when you click the scoreboard, obviously like the, games that were supposed to be played come up and, you know, it's kind of my access point into a lot of the different team by team information and preparing for what this conversation was going to be about. And so I noticed that like Ohio State Penn State was supposed to be on Sunday night and I was like, ugh. Like I had originally tweeted about the what was supposed to be the first ACC Thursday night game, which I believe was Duke Carolina, and we never even got that. So to a degree, the loss doesn't feel as bad. And for as much as I have a love-hate relationship with Big Ten Sunday Night Lacrosse because it pushes back Quinn and my's ability to record our podcast later, and later on Sunday night, it did, you know, really, really kind of burrow its way into the nether regions of my heart. And so missing out on that game, which, you know, because it's setting the table for what you and I are going to talk about. It just, there were so many unknowns and so many seeds that were planted because like when I think about watching Ohio State Cornell and, you know, seeing what we saw of Penn State. And so Ohio State was a team that I felt really, like I didn't have my arms around. I was like, they could be, you know, a top 10, 11 team, or they could be a top 30 team. And I felt like that game really kind of confirmed my position that they were, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th best in the country. You know, Penn State, on the other hand, was a consensus preseason, number one, number two, or number three. You know, they had lost twice. So I think to some degree, folks were like, maybe they weren't as good as we thought they were going to be coming into the season. Talking to Jeff Tambroni last week, I do agree that actually losing to Yale, losing to Cornell were probably two really beneficial losses for understanding how to battle through adversity and preparing them for the second half of the season. And so the idea of seeing those two teams tangle on Sunday night is so appealing, and now we don't have it.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this weekend's schedule, and it's tough because, you know, teams that I covered multiple times this year are Johns Hopkins and Penn State. Two of them, they're playing on Saturday, so I probably would have ended up there. Oh man, that would have been a good one. Syracuse, North Carolina is this weekend. Villanova, Georgetown is a afternoon game. You got Notre Dame Army, which is always just a fun game. Yeah, it's a lot. UMBC Albany was a sneaky game to watch this weekend. It kind of makes you, you know, I'm getting back to there, like I said, and looking at the calendar, but it does make you sad. It does make you wonder, and it does like kind of like bring you back to like, oh my God, this is not normal what we're going through right now.
Well, let's try to reclaim a little bit of normalcy and a little bit of happiness. And what better way to do that than by talking about the best players in college lacrosse? And I think typically, well, so a couple things. First, I've been doing the Player of the Year watch since 2008. So I kind of consider myself a little bit the de facto Player of the Year guy, ranking the top 10 players in college lacrosse, et cetera, et cetera. But you've taken a lot of initiative over the course of this season, particularly in helping us guide this conversation. So you've got your list. I haven't actually done my list yet. So we figured that it would make good for a good podcast to kind of talk through it. And traditionally, we would do that by probably starting at the bottom and working our way up. But I think you and I kind of agree, and I think most of our listeners will agree, that we're going to go in reverse order because it's going to be more interesting. And it's simply because the guy at the top of the list is pretty close to as undisputed as it possibly gets.
Yeah, and that's – well, but it's funny because, like, yes, Michael Sowers is undisputed. He's the Player of the Year. There's no doubt. You know, through this stretch of games, he's the Player of the Year. But there is that question of the Tworton, you know, and the Player of the Year, the Tworton specifically, is so weighted towards postseason play. You know, it's such a, you know, you got to have a good year, but then what you do in May puts you over the top. We have a, you know, 5, 6, 7 game sample for these players. How do you account for that? You know, there is the question of, do we try to project how good the team was going to be and kind of have that as some sort of correlation of the players, you know, ability to win the Player of the Year watch? It's tough. I think it has to be done on what happened, but, you know, it needs to be a team that we project would have been at least relevant through the end of conference play. Michael Sowers was having such
a
season.
Let me jump in there because I actually think that there's one factor that you left out that I think is way, way more important than it would be in a given year. And that
they played.
No. I wasn't even going to say that. I was going to say, what were your preseason expectations? And particularly, how much did you exceed your preseason expectations? Because there are a handful of guys that we're going to talk about that had really, really good years, but they kind of met their expectations, right? They didn't exceed their expectations. And, you know, Michael Sowers put up 16 goals and 31 assists in 5 games. Like, the Tigers were 5-0 for the first time in a long time. They beat the defending national champions on the road. And I think that's what we're talking about, right? Like, that is, you know, Sowers was probably like right there with Granite. You know, I think Granite was more clearly the Tworton favorite heading into this year than any single team was, the preseason number one. Sowers was probably like 2, depending on how you felt about a couple other guys. He might have been anywhere between 2 and 5. TD was certainly in that mix as well. But he exceeded expectations, you know, both in terms of production and in terms of how good his team was. And he put up some highlights in order to do it. So I think that the culmination of those three factors are why I don't really think there's a real argument for anybody else.
There certainly is not. And I think you would agree that I've been banging the Michael Sowers drum pretty hard for a while now. And I think preseason I was the most excited for him of anyone in the office in terms of his potential to win this award. I think that's fair.
I would say that. And I actually want to ask when you think you jumped onto that. Because, like, for me, my eyes were open to Sowers when Jeff Shannon wrote an article the summer. I can't recall if it would have been it was the summer of U19 tryouts, because it was when he got admitted to the hospital for dehydration because he just went so hard for like 11 straight days or something like that. So I feel like it was the summer heading into his senior year of high school. And at that point, I was like, oh man, you know, this guy, he is not just super quick and really skilled. Like, he's got that kind of, you know, intangible toughness that takes a good player and makes him into a great player. And then obviously the narrative over his 3 years in college had been the fact that he hadn't made it to the postseason. but you've seen him up close and personal, and I've got my idea for when, you know, he really kind of turned the corner for you, so to speak, and both metaphorically and literally, in terms of the or the opinion that you had of him.
Yeah, well, I think all of this is a little bit colored by, I think he's just one of my favorite players I've ever covered in my life, and that comes from his ability on the field. He's just the nicest kid in the world, and I just think he is, like, kind of very much the model of a student athlete in a lot of things he does. But, you know, I think, oh God, that's a good question, the way you put it. I went to a Princeton fall ball practice, which I want to say was probably going into his sophomore year, maybe going into his junior year. I'm not certain. But there was a point when, and I might be getting some of the details of this wrong, so I think the spirit of the story remains, but, you know, I might have some details wrong. But there was a point when I think freshmen had to stay out there for, like, a final phase of practice, and he clearly was not a freshman. He clearly was the best player on the team and one of the best players in the country at that point. And he stuck around the whole time and worked with all these kids to try to make them better. Was one thing that just, I think, kind of showed his character to me. But from an on-field performance, when I saw at the Naval Academy, Princeton versus Navy, and he just kind of dominated, that's when I was like, this is a player that every coach is throwing every sort of thing that they have at him. You know, they're going to try to Jamie Moyer him. They're going to try to, like, do all these, like, weird, you know, just throw junk at him and see what happens. And
Jamie Moyer him. Oh my God, that's unbelievable. See, that's why the podcast listeners show up when McAneer makes an appearance. Oh my goodness. The youngest among you, Jamie Moyer was a Major League Baseball pitcher for like 21 years, and I always remember and associate him with the Seattle Mariners, because when I was in the height of my Cleveland Indians fandom, that's where he was throwing the junk. What, is he a Mariner in your memory as well?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
But
all right, so the Navy defense, Ryan Wilner's defense, was Jamie Moyering Michael Sowers.
And, like, it was just that, like, and it was nothing that Navy did wrong. It was just that, like, there was no, and I don't remember what Sowers put up. He was something like 8 or 9 points.
I've got the box score right here. So he was 2-7. Princeton won 19-11, and it was on Tuesday, March 5th, 2019.
Yeah, and it was just one of those, like, they tried to kind of essentially not play him. Would be the very, very, like, layman's term way to put it. And, you know, he basically had Navy hung up. And he was just operating from X. And I said to Rick Soule after the game that he reminded me of Wayne Gretzky. You know how, like, Wayne Gretzky is, like, always like to operate from behind the net, and just he could see the whole field. Like, that's kind of the way he picked them apart. And it was just like, and again, it wasn't like Navy did a stupid move. It was just there was no way. So you might as well just try something and see what the heck works against this kid. That being that undefendable, but only not only that, but so much where you take other teams out of their game plan, is really what enlightened me that this is a special player.
So I was talking to a Princeton super fan this year about what he felt like was different for Sowers in 2020 versus in the prior 3 years. And it was really interesting because, you know, I am very much I got to see it before I believe it type of thing, particularly with, you know, teams, programs, players around whom there's like a long track record of one type of product or output or outcome. And one of the things that, you know, one of the ways I framed my question was, so Sowers has been really good for 3 years and Princeton has been essentially a 500 team since he's been there. And we were having this conversation after the season was canceled. And I was like, a lot of people attributed Syracuse's uptick in production and quality to Pat March's arrival. So how do you reconcile that with potentially a similar uptick in Princeton's production and Pat March's departure? And he didn't necessarily answer the question directly, but he did talk about the differences in the way that Sowers was being utilized and the way that he was being played. And it's interesting when you consider and look at, you know, the Media All-America voting and see a guy like Connor McCarthy, who is a senior midfielder who had 6 points last year, and in 5 games he had 13 goals and an assist. He was the third leading scorer for Princeton, and he was one of two guys with Chris Brown, who this fan pointed out as being huge bodies that it seemed like were so frequently setting screens that Sowers was able to come off of. And he talked about how they were using Sowers above GLE more than he had ever been used previously in his career. And that by doing so, he found himself much more frequently in situations where coming off of a screen, he was able to make kind of half cut or one cut decisions around and utilize that kind of momentary separation that he was getting off of these big body screens and how frequently it was yielding a good look for a teammate. And when you look at Princeton's box scores, you know, they tend to be, they weren't getting like playmaking. They weren't getting assist production really from anybody else. Now when you have 31 assists in five games, you know, it basically means you're averaging six assists a game. There aren't that many additional assists to go around because you're going to get some unassisted goals, even if you're putting up, you know, 18 goals a game. And it was really eye-opening because when you think about the combination of his stature, his athletic profile, which, you know, is certainly around his quickness, and the accuracy of his passing and his ability to throw guys open, the idea of all it takes is, you know, kind of just getting a shoulder onto his defender in order to get him that half step makes a lot of sense. And you know, by the measure of a couple of other people who watched Princeton play a lot this year, that was a fair assessment.
A mind-boggling stat here for you. His assist to turnover ratio is 3.1. So 31 assists, 10 turnovers, you know, 9.4 points per game. The next, and actually this is actually a really interesting exercise. I think this is a cool number. With a minimum of 20 points, assist to turnover leaders, do you have any idea who, if you could guess your top five?
This year. Okay, yeah, not all time. Oh my goodness. All right, well, so I'm going to assume Chris Gray is in there. It's been too long since I looked at the assist leaders. I'm going to assume Grant Ament is in there as well. I'm going to assume Jeff Teat is not, because I bet he's got like, bet he's like in the like 1.5 neighborhood, because he's probably, I think he just turns the ball over a little bit more frequently. Let's see. Can I get a hint on any others?
You got one, and then you were way off about Jeff Teat.
Oh, okay. So is he like second?
He's four. So it's Michael Sowers.
Yep.
Nicky Solomon.
Okay.
16 assists, 6 turnovers, 2.67. Stephen Rafis.
Oh, 2.57. Yeah.
Assist to turnover ratio. I think, half of these assists were in that Hopkins game, I believe, right? 18 assists, 7 turnovers, 2.57. Jeff Teat is 15 assists, 6 turnovers, 2.5.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Have a season, Jeff Teat.
Yeah. Grant Ament is 1.88, 32-17. Which is pretty just remarkable. 32 assists is just absolutely crazy.
Totally. But the fact that Sowers had 7 fewer turnovers and only 1 fewer assist is exactly the evidence that you need in order to demonstrate exactly how efficient and productive he was this season. But we've spent a lot of time talking about these, and we mentioned a handful of guys that also are in consideration and on your list. So we're going to skip number 2 for the time being because we haven't brought him up. He plays a different position. But number 3 and number 4 in your list are Chris Gray and Grant Ament. What were the thought processes that led to that?
Yeah, I mean, Gray, just his overall, like, he's kind of, you know, he what's the expression? The rising tide raises all boats?
Yep.
You know, he just was the piece at North Carolina and made everyone around him so much better. You know, I almost feel like you collectively have to like look at his stats and then add in everyone else's on North Carolina as like the reason why Chris Gray is so good.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense whatsoever, I'm not sure if it does. Grant Ament, you know,
well, hold on before like, we move on from that. I want to quickly touch on just the role that a guy like Gray plays on a team like that, because when North Carolina won the championship in 2016, you know, I made a big deal about Pontrello's role as the facilitator. And, you know, he was a converted midfielder, but he was so good at putting a pressure from behind and drawing a number one matchup and being able to consistently, you know, kind of draw slides, and how it really crystallized what I thought was kind of a linchpin of Dave Metzbauer offenses, which is that ability to be multi-directional in the sense that you can attack from up top and behind. And so 2017, 18, and even 2019, you know, you saw fits and starts with different kind of personnel options that were going to try to fill that role, and it just didn't come to fruition. And here you get it, you know, one, probably the biggest offseason transfer of the year last summer, and a guy who was, you know, kind of a stiffed as a Twarton finalist, the second or third leading scorer in college lacrosse last year, and he steps right in and demonstrates both that proficiency in play behind the goal as well as kind of a natural playmaking ability. And then in Gray's case, and I think we saw this in their Hopkins game, the ability to complement that with being a mid-range shooter such that you can never really ignore him when the ball's not in his stick the way maybe you might be able to with some other ex-attackmen. All of a sudden, now there's just so much more space. There's such easier looks. There's fewer double teams. Defense is rotating faster. And I think that's what you saw with why it felt like Gray's arrival maybe was not kind of like a plus one, but more like a plus 1.5 or even a plus two in terms of the way that it impacted everything else that was going on offensively.
Yeah, I mean, and there's the, you know, when we come back to the whole like partial season question, North Carolina, of I think most of the teams we're going to be talking about here, had the easiest schedule. You know, Chris Gray, he did bring it though, again, in the games that he needed to, Denver and Johns Hopkins. So how much do you account for that in terms of, you know, North Carolina, like as a whole, and Chris Gray in terms of this player of the year? 7-0, obviously you got to win the games that are on your schedule. We saw, and everything that you said is exactly why I have him so high up here. But I could understand if you think he was going to cool off as it went into ACC play in terms of the rate of his numbers and what that meant for his player of the year.
Right. You were about to talk to us about Grant Ament, so by all means, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Grant, like, I think he is what he is, you know. He's exactly what how good we know he is, which is very good and among the best players in the country. And I think he probably got a little more flack than he deserved this year because he wasn't, like, it wasn't like a video game. But, I mean, like, we were just looking at his assist numbers, and that's just mind-boggling. His expectations were so high that I think people like kind of had it in their head that he didn't have as great of a season, but I mean, he's a first team All-American. He's one of the best players in the country. He brought it this year. You know, he had that, I'd say, bad first half against Yale where Chris Fake, I thought, really got the better of him. But even in that game, I think he had something like 7 points. He's just as good as it gets, and he makes that whole team. He's a leader on that team. Penn State was going to be in that mix. You know, I like I said, they're also in the same boat as Grant of, for whatever reason, they had a few struggles, and it seems like people almost wrote them off a little bit, which I don't think is fair.
So you had an opportunity to see him in the fall take on Virginia, and it turned out that ended up being a very pivotal game, both in his season and in his career, relative to the fact that he did re-injure his foot. That injury required surgery. It was to the point that there was some conversation that maybe he wasn't going to be ready to start the season. Not only did he start the season, but to your point, he played really, really well. And the fact that he did that on a foot that had been surgically repaired and also suffered a setback in the fall, you know, I remember talking to you after that game, and it was really, I think, where your point of view on how good Penn State was going to be was solidified. The fact that he probably didn't get quite back to that level athletically, physically, by virtue of all the setbacks that he sustained, which he later cited as being one of the reasons that he felt like it was time to move on from his time in a Penn State uniform. And also the fact that his injury wasn't just about playing through pain. It was also about the fact that he couldn't practice during the week. I mean, I think when you add the conditions, and it, to a degree, that's not fair because we don't know what everybody else was dealing with as well. But certainly for, you know, knowing that, it puts his production and Penn State's quality into another level of context.
And to build on that, I was at that game and I didn't realize he broke his foot. And like he kept, you know, he kept playing at least a little bit of time on it from what I understand. So that's pretty remarkable in itself, the way that he was able to kind of hide that. Granted, it was also like a natural time when star players were going to be leaving the field and, you know, some other guys are going to get some run. But man, that's just remarkable. And he's just another great kid. And, you know, I wrote a story about after that Penn State Yale game about how his ability to, after a game when you just lost, particularly a high profile game that, you know, you're really emotionally invested in, he just did absolutely everything that you would ask of a player to do. He could basically recount specific plays, with, you know, just like with perfect vision, with, you know, perfect perspective on how the play went, which is something that coaches cannot do after a game. You know, you ask a coach about a specific play, and they're just like, I don't know, I haven't watched the film yet. Right. He could relay anything. And he, you know, did everything about challenging his teammates, but also lifting up his teammates, for a lot of those intangible reasons. And maybe those aren't fair because I get, you know, maybe more access to these guys than other people. And some players I get more access to than others. But that's why he's so high on my list.
So just to kind of build out that analogy or metaphor a little bit, you know, it's really tempting to compare different elements of sport to great players and teams. So Patrick Mahomes or, you know, whatever else, Lionel Messi falls into that category. But for the last almost year, I've been comparing Penn State's offense to Golden State Warriors. And I did so kind of in a way that I didn't really even realize one element until Jack Kelly. So we saw the news last week that Mack O'Keefe is going to come back and play with his additional year of eligibility at Penn State. And I thought it was hilarious that in a video that was posted of O'Keefe's goals, Jack Kelly, his teammate, replied something to the effect of, yeah, I was open on half those, but go ahead and shoot from 17. And it really did demonstrate kind of like what one of my biggest takeaways was watching Penn State, particularly down the stretch last season, which is Grant Amendt's ability to throw assist passes that are 25 yards in the air was uncanny and really almost unmatched. And not only that, but so frequently he did it with his feet set and in a position that he was really not considered dangerous by the defender. Those factors kind of combined to make me feel like he was Steph Curry and Mack O'Keefe was Klay Thompson. And for basketball fans, you can kind of play that string out a little bit further to the point that you just made, which is Steph Curry is considered to be one of the most likable stars in NBA history. He is incredibly articulate when it comes to his ability to explain the way in which the game works and unfolds. He is definitely the beneficiary of success in the sense that once you have won at a high level, the ability to handle hard questions, particularly after disappointing losses, is a little bit easier, right? But yeah, I mean, I would really think a little bit more about that analogy because a lot of what you just said speaks to Grant's star potential. And as he transitions into the next phase of his lacrosse career, it'll be really fascinating to see how that continues to come to fruition and manifest itself.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be, you know, he even said, like, at the end of when I talked to him for a story on the website, he's like, yeah, hopefully I get drafted. It's like, no, dude, you're getting drafted. you're gonna be in the PLL. Don't worry about that.
All right, we got to pick up the pace a little bit here. So moving along, I'm not sure how necessarily you want to organize some of the rest of these, but you had a Syracuse midfielder at number 5. There were a lot of Syracuse options to pick from, and you settled on Jamie Trimboli.
It's funny, the thing that I kept coming back to. Well, and first of all, this list that I put out is in our. We have a company Slack channel. And this was essentially, all right, guys, let's talk about player of the year. Here's the first 10 names that come to my mind. Let's debate them.
Yeah.
So set the table here for this is kind of the like the first draft. And we're going from and this conversation will probably dictate how I change some of these. But for Trimboli, I kept coming back to Dave Petromala's comment after the game that Syracuse came down to Homewood and really kind of took it to the Blue Jays there. Obviously, Rafus was kind of the star of that game, but he was talking about their midfield, and Petromala said, you know, this was the best midfield he has seen out of Syracuse in recent history. So by that, I think he's kind of talking about the last decade is what I would say what he was thinking. And he was describing the players, and he didn't really have the, like, Dordovic, he was just talking about how he's such a good dodger and so quick and can kind of have those dodges that make the guys fall down and look spectacular. And he was talking about Toffoli, and he was like, he's just the best lacrosse player out there, is what he said. And I really kind of came back to that of, you know, if we're talking about the Tourton, it's an award that, you know, at least for a time, midfielders, you know, used to get a lot of looks in that. He's got that classic, just he does everything really well. He produces. He was on the best first midfield unit in the country. And he might not be as flashy as those other guys, but I think he is the combination of production and just glue and leadership that made that whole group really good.
17 goals and 3 assists for 20 points in 5 games. He was the second leading scorer. Chase Scanlon had 23 points on 18 and 5, certainly bolstered by that 7-goal outing in, I believe, their season debut versus Colgate. Stephen Rafis also had 20 points, as you said, 2 goals and 18 assists, which is a silly, silly stat line. Brennan Curry had 17 points, and Tugger Dordovic, who you mentioned, had 14. Trimboli also had his quote-unquote Tourton moment, or, you know, started to develop a little bit of a Tourton moment type highlight season with the goal against Army, which, you know, probably ended up being Syracuse's most important win of the season.
Yeah, and I mean, he's the senior in that group. You know, I know the other guys have, you know, when you look at Curry and you look at Dordovic, you know, they're obviously experienced and they've gone through, at least particularly in Dordovic's case, those things that forge leadership. But, you know, I'll kind of go with the senior when you go with that group.
So we've broken from talking about attackmen. Might as well circle back to your number two choice and talk about the greatest faceoff specialist of all time, T.D. Erlin, who we don't know his status in terms of the likelihood that he's going to return. We do know that he said recently that if he does play another year of college lacrosse, it will be for Yale. And in that story, I was just kind of, you know, reminded of the fact that he broke every all-time face-off record this season, and including the all-time wins record against Michigan in California late on a Saturday night. He didn't necessarily have an eye-popping win rate through 4 games because he wasn't over 80%, I don't believe, which he has been at this point in the season earlier in his career, but certainly was off to yet another fantastic start for a Bulldog team that, despite a blemish against UMass, looks like everything folks expected them to be.
Well, the fact that you're holding them up to an 80% standard, I think, is pretty much says all you need to say about him. Exactly. You know, he did it seem like that whole all-time face-off record just kind of didn't happen? Like it kind of, I know, like it was obviously a Saturday night. It was a 10 o'clock start on the East Coast, at least. It just felt like that didn't really get the attention that it deserved. You know,
but there's, I also think that reflects expectations. I think everybody knew coming into the season that TD was going to break this record, so it didn't. It wasn't exciting, right? It wasn't is he going to do it? It was just like, oh yeah, is he going to do it in the third game or the fourth game? Was kind of the way in which people addressed that heading into the year, and it was probably going to be a function of how many goals Yale scored. It wasn't really going to have that much to do with how successful he was.
Well, random thing is, so we were watching the, this is a random tangent, the Notre Dame-Yale quarterfinal game. I'm sorry, the Notre Dame Albany quarterfinal game
from 2015. Yeah.
The 2015 one, the one that was out in Denver. And somehow we had a tangent about what team would win, the all-time Notre Dame team or the all-time Yale team, the all-time Albany team. Sorry, excuse me. If you put them, you know, face to face. And we were talking about it and then I remember just chiming in. I was like, you guys are missing the one big factor, and that's Albany would have T.D. Erlin.
Right.
And, like, even sophomore T.D. Erlin is such a huge chip. The point I'm trying to make in a very, very roundabout way is that Sowers is the player of the year. Erlin is easily the most important player on any team, which it's tough to have that distinction of, you know, player of the year versus most important player. But if you take Erlin out of the picture, that changes the makeup of Yale significantly. You add him to any team in the country and they immediately become, you know, so much better. Sowers is also in that realm, but, you know, the faceoff guy just has such influence on a game and able to take it over that he is clearly the most important player on any team in the country.
There's no disputing it, and really, I don't have very much to add. Hope we get to see him in a Yale uniform one more time. Let's quickly run through your numbers 6 through 10, because I got a couple of bones to pick. Number 6, Jeff Teat. Number 7, Jake Caraway. Number 8, Tanner Cook. Number 9, JT Giles-Harris. And number 10, Mac O'Keefe. So you've got three attackmen, a middie, and a defenseman. Jeff Teat at number 6, I probably would have him at number 5. I think he deserves to be a Thornton finalist. I think that his, to whatever degree you might try to criticize the way in which Cornell's season unfolded or his season unfolded in 2020, it would be his teammates were better than we expected them to be. So maybe he wasn't quite as good as we expected him to be. And when I hear that argument, not just related to Cornell and Jeff Teat, but kind of all across the board, my bat signal immediately goes up. So what was your thought process, or what is your opinion of the year that Jeff Teat had?
You know, he's probably the guy that in this list, in the final list, will probably move up. I couldn't say definitively who he would take out of that top five right now, but I certainly see him going up to the top five for sure. Another guy that, you know, that assist to turnover ratio that I really like, which I looked at after I did this list, by the way. and, you know, he's like that goal that he had to tie the game against Penn State is essentially everything you need to know about him in one moment. You know, with all these guys, Teat might be the one of all of them, all the offensive players at least, that you're going to put the ball on his stick if you need a goal with a minute left.
Right.
You know, I think there is some sort of narrative about him that's, you know, maybe not, there's, it's not a truthful narrative about just like his performance in postseason. But man, he's like, if I'm going to give someone the ball with a minute left and we have a tie game, I'm going to give it to Jeff Teat of anyone that we've mentioned on this list.
It's really interesting to consider when you kind of look at him from a physicality and from a physique standpoint, you're just like, yeah, I mean, he's thin, he's not very tall, but he's so slippery and he's so deceptive. And late in games, those are the attributes that lead to goals. So I can certainly see where you're coming from in terms of the value of what he brings to the table.
But it's that box thing of just like, you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like the short time, like I'm going to have to power through some people. I'm going to get hit. But the ball's got to go in the net somehow, whether I do it or pass it to someone. It's just that box mentality that just adds that element.
There is an interesting consideration and wrinkle to be thrown into this, though, with Jake Caraway, who I think lives at the other end of the spectrum. And I think that, you know, it's not to take away either his skill or his game sense or his deceptiveness or his slipperiness, but I do think that he is a monster athlete and probably the most underrated athlete in college lacrosse this year in terms of his ability to be productive and the way in which he made that Georgetown offense home, which is interesting because I would actually say that if that is indeed the case, then he's kind of the third in a legacy of you know, guys who had kind of filled that bill most recently and specifically Dan Beccaro in successive years for Kevin Warren's team.
Yeah, and those guys for whatever reason, I mean, it's just the strength of schedule that Georgetown has at this stretch makes it difficult to make kind of, you know, bold predictions about them in terms of what they're going to do when they get to Big East play and what they're going to do in the NCAA tournament. You know, there really wasn't a noteworthy game on their schedule. And, you know, if we would have had one more weekend and we would have had them versus North Carolina, like that would have revealed so much about either team. So it's really a shame we didn't get that game. But, you know, what is it about these Georgetown attackmen kind of being under the radar and being maybe a little bit unnoticed? I'm not really sure. But 34 points through, you know, 6 games, leading a team that's undefeated and ranked in the, I'm assuming they're in the top 10. The final poll was like a month ago, so I'm not really even certain about that. But, you know, he's got to be on this list.
The other guy that would have kind of fallen in front of Beccaro would have been Craig Burge, just in terms of like one of those offensive players who was kind of an otherworldly talent that it just felt like, whether it was injury or the kind of rising nature of Georgetown, just wasn't necessarily like top of mind relative to this conversation. And I think Caraway, for me, you know, has kind of solidified his position there. But the next guy is a guy who I think kind of had again, in my mind, a little bit of untapped potential the last 2 years and was starting to realize it, but was also the beneficiary of Chris Gray that we talked about. Tanner Cook, who we would have seen against Georgetown had the season lasted 1 year longer, one weekend longer. I've always just the image or the overriding idea that I've had around Tanner Cook has been formed since the, I guess it would be fall of 2017 when we were filming the season 2018, and Jason Johnson, the video guy who was a quarterback at Arizona and then spent years in the NFL, CFL, has been around just a tremendous number of world-class athletes and has that eye for athleticism that transcends sports. Even if he's not a super fluent lacrosse guy, he still kind of gets it. You know, Tanner Cook was the first guy on the field that, by being up close and personal with North Carolina, Ohio State, Duke, and Syracuse, Tanner Cook was the one that he's like, that's the guy. That is a special player. And he's a shooter for sure. And we started to see him realize that potential and productivity over the course of this season.
For sure. And, you know, just that production from the midfield is pretty just remarkable. I mean, you can't deny that. And, you know, kind of similar with Chris Gray, like Chris Gray is the star, but every piece on that North Carolina team was just so much better and was playing more than 100% of what they're supposed to get out of them. You know, it really was a special group.
Continuing on down the list at number 9, JT Giles Harris, the lone defenseman on the list, and then number 10, Mack O'Keefe. You know, so Giles Harris, there's a lot of questions around how do you value defensive players here, and if you're going to try to get some representation from the defensive end of the field on this, you know, how typically is it going to manifest itself? Is it going to be that long pole who runs the field and makes plays offensively? Is it going to be a goalie who, you know, really kind of raises the level from a production and productivity standard? So Giles Harris, certainly the leading vote getter among the media All-Americans for among close defensemen. He is an incredibly athletic lockdown guy, can take his matchup out of the game. I don't think Duke's defense met the standard that was expected of it heading into the season this year. So, you know, it's really one of those questions of how much responsibility do you put on a senior leader for the unit's overall success in production versus his own ability to take really talented opponents out of the game.
And there needs to be another defender list because, you know, if we're using Tuorton as our model in some ways of the player of the year, we know it's not going to be a defenseman unless there's something just outrageously special. And that player has not emerged yet in this season. So there actually is a player who, when we get to the end, is, I think, my biggest miss in this first 10 that I put together that I'm going to kind of bring back to the table for when we debate it some more.
So I've got a couple that I'm going to add to that, but quickly on O'Keefe, I mean, first and foremost, just want to say really glad and excited to learn that he's going to be back for the 2021 season. And also the type of guy who, when you're paired with another really productive player, and particularly when you're the goal scorer, sometimes your production and your contribution can be undervalued. And the guy who kind of put this on my radar was Dylan Sheridan when he was the head coach at Cleveland State and the Vikings played Penn State the year that Ament was missed due to injury, which was 2018. At the time, in my mind, Mack O'Keefe was a feet-set shooter with good range. And Dylan, in a conversation that I had with him, was just like, nope, he's better than that. He is an all-around player who can make things happen. And obviously we saw Penn State, you know, their season faltered in kind of the way that some seasons can in really competitive conferences where, you know, a good record doesn't manifest itself into a postseason berth, and that's what happened. So maybe that 2018 season feels a little bit lost to history, but certainly we're going to get an opportunity to see, you know, with all the attention and expectations squarely on Penn State and Mack O'Keefe's shoulders next year, what that looks like.
I mean, he's got the best passer, you know, and you said, like, the phrase that you said, like, he's a great assist passer, I think is a key when you're talking about Grant. Is key in that, you know, the ball is basically right in O'Keefe's wheelhouse. But, you know, I think O'Keefe is the kind of guy who can have a bad pass thrown to him and is going to score. He just has so many different release points and, like, you know, he can be kind of like crouched down and get the ball and still release it in a fraction of a second, and it's going to be a goal. It's just really tremendously impressive. Not shooter, but goal scorer.
So you mentioned guys that didn't make your top 10. Quickly, three that jump out for me. Jack Hanna, the leading vote-getter at midfield, the Denver midfielder who led the Pioneers in scoring, which was a pretty ridiculous stat when you consider who he would be flanked by. Matt Moore, who was kind of emerged over the course of the last 2 years as Virginia's talisman offensive playmaker, and Logan Musnauskas, who I think took a tremendous step forward this season. You know, in I was at Maryland's win over Notre Dame when they really pulled away in kind of the second half down the stretch, and I thought that it was Musnauskas's versatility that kind of created so many problems for Notre Dame defensively that they weren't expecting, and I thought that it demonstrated the growth and becoming a counterpart to Jared Bernhardt and that trigger man type thing that we expect out of number one attackman that I thought was going to make Maryland a really tough out over the course of the rest of the season. So those would be three guys that I would throw into the conversation as we continue to develop the top 10 player of the year watch list.
Yeah, for sure. Wisnowskis was the one that I was specifically referring to in terms of like needs to be on that list that was left out. And it is like, you know, to use another sports analogy, I kind of viewed him as like Alex Ovechkin from a few years ago, you know, just like he has that sweet spot that he sits there and scores from there all the time. And that's really, really good, but it's not exactly versatile. But I saw the same thing against their game against High Point of him scoring in multiple spots, you know, passing the ball really well, doing a lot of stuff off ball with the ball. You know, he's got he added some stuff to his tool chest this year. And, you know, Maryland's a team you can count on being relevant at the end of the year. So, like, he was going to have success and Maryland was going to have success for sure.
And I'm sorry, I said that there were three guys, but there was one that I left out, which I guess I can say that I was speaking for you, and Wisnowskis doesn't count as one of my three. Brennan Nichtern, who was an honorable or third-team All-America selection. He's the third-leading scorer in the nation, and Army was one of the most interesting teams so far this season. You know, they had that big season-opening win over UMass and then the very surprising upset against Marist. And we were just really excited to see who this Black Knight team was going to become. And certainly the answer was going to be dictated in large part by the type of year that Nichtern was going to have as a sophomore.
Just the other first-team All-American offensive player we're leaving out here, Connor Kirst.
Yeah, how about that?
Guy's just a monster. We have a photo of him against Hofstra. And he just is absolutely barreling over whoever's defending him. He's just a complete monster. And he can do, like, I don't know, I feel like he's been pigeonholed as just, like, this big guy who puts a shoulder into someone and scores off that. But, you know, he's taken faceoffs. He played wing. He's a really versatile guy for them.
Well, Matt, I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been helpful to take my mind off of what else is going on out there in the world. We appreciate your time on the Inside the Cross podcast. We're glad to hear that your family is safe and healthy. We hope that all of our listeners are experiencing the same. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Hit us up on social media at @inside_lacrosse on Twitter, at @insidelacrosse on Instagram. He's at Matt Kinnear. I'm at Terrence Foy with one R. And we'll be back later in the week with more Inside the Cross podcasts.